On behalf of JLL Income Property Trust, I'd like to welcome you to their first quarter 2020 earnings conference call. This call is being recorded and our audience lines are currently in a listen-only mode. A question and answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Jill Passman from JLL Income Property Trust. Jill, please go ahead.
Welcome everyone to today's call. Any statements made about future results and performance or about plans, expectations, or objectives are forward-looking statements. Actual results and performance may differ from those included in the forward-looking statements as a result of factors discussed in the company's annual report on Form 10-K for the year ended December 31, 2019, and in our other reports filed with the SEC. The company disclaims any undertaking to update or revise any forward-looking statements. In addition, all non-GAAP financial measures discussed during this call are reconciled to their most directly comparable GAAP financial measures in accordance with the SEC rules in our Form 10-Q for the quarter ended March 31, 2020. Links to a transcript and audio replay of this call will be posted and available on our website, jllipt.com. For further information on the company's performance, we invite you to review our quarterly report on Form 10-Q filed on May 8, 2020, and other filings which are available on the company's website, as well as the SEC's website, sec.gov. Now I would like to turn the call over to Alan Swearingen, President and Chief Executive Officer, and Greg Falk, Chief Financial Officer. At the conclusion of their comments, we will open the call for your questions. Alan, if you'd like to begin.
Thanks, Jill. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this review of our first quarter 2020 results in these unprecedented times. Before we delve into our performance for the quarter, I would like to take a moment to express our sympathies to everyone around the world who is coping with the virus's severe consequences. With the ongoing spread of COVID-19 and the incredible speed at which things are changing around us, we are continually adapting to these changes. Our first priority is the safety and well-being of our colleagues and their families, our business partners, our investors, tenants, and the communities where we operate. We have been following guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and local health authorities in the 27 different markets in which we own and operate our 78 properties to ensure we have the plans and resources in place to safeguard the health and well-being of the tenants operating or living in our properties. It is a shared realization that we all face new challenges nearly every day. Despite the uncertainty of the depth and duration of this crisis, we remain optimistic about the long-term prospects of the commercial real estate industry and the value proposition of our conservative approach to investing in core real estate. Though the crisis will force the rethinking of many aspects of our world, the function of commercial real estate will still be necessary, and investors will continue to see real estate as an attractive investment for capital. With that backdrop, we will now turn to recapping Q1 performance. JLL Income Property Trust continues to focus on managing and improving our $3.3 billion portfolio of 78 core properties spanning the apartment, industrial, office, and grocery-anchored retail property sectors. In the first quarter, we recognized moderate declines in property valuations that occurred late in March due to COVID-19 impacts on less than 30% of our overall portfolio. Across all share classes, net of fees, we realized an approximate 1% positive income return, an approximate 2.3% negative appreciation return, and an overall 1.3% negative return for Q1 2020. Quarterly dividends have now been paid for 33 consecutive quarters, with an average annual increase of 4.5% over that 8-plus year period. Before diving into the details of our first quarter accomplishments, I will provide an overview of the broader economic environment in which we operated. The first quarter of 2020 saw a rapid deterioration of economic conditions following the outbreak of COVID-19, and the global economic closures to contain the pandemic. These started to impact the U.S. in the second half of March, but even still, U.S. GDP shrank by 4.8% in Q1, driven largely by a decline in consumer spending. We expect the negative impact on GDP will be even more material in the second quarter. This historic decline in economic activity is having a major impact on the labor market. The U.S. experienced its largest unemployment contraction in history, with 21.4 million jobs lost during March and April, as the unemployment rate surged to 14.7%. Job losses occurred across numerous industries, although the service economy, particularly the retail, hospitality, and healthcare sectors, bore the brunt of the impact. Uncertainty remains extremely high in terms of both the extent of the pandemic's economic impact and the timing and path of the recovery. Due to the nature of this shock, the deepest trough of the downturn is likely to come much quicker. Then, while some segments of the economy will start to recover, others will likely see longer-term challenges. The silver lining of the very dark cloud over the labor market is that many of the people who lost their jobs, approximately three-quarters, report that it is a temporary layoff. Simply getting those people on temporary layoff back to work could go a long way, but not all the way, towards a healthier labor market. The effects on U.S. property markets is only partially captured in data on first quarter fundamentals, and we expect further impacts to show up in the second quarter and beyond. In the first quarter, vacancy rates moved higher across most property types, with retail seeing the greatest increase. Open-air vacancy increased by 20 basis points to 6.7%, driven by negative net absorption. With the exception of grocers, pharmacies, and other essential retailers, a steep drop-off in retail sales has led many retailers to request some form of rent relief for April 2020. According to an April NAREIT survey, approximately 53% of publicly traded REIT shopping center tenants made rent payments on time. National office vacancy also rose 20 basis points to 12.3% in Q1, with net absorption decelerating to its slowest pace in 7 years. Industrial vacancy rose 10 basis points to 4.5% as absorption showed signs of resilience. National apartment vacancy actually decreased 40 basis points from the previous year to 4.2%, although the positive trend in that sector is not expected to be sustained. Apartment rent payments were stronger than many expected in April, with only 4% of Class A tenants nationally not paying their rent, according to a JLL survey. In the year ending with Q1 2020, industrial had the strongest rent growth, followed in order by office, apartments, and retail. Expectations for near-term construction completions have shifted downward, as in-progress construction projects were delayed in many markets and developers were reluctant to start new projects. The 2020 supply pipeline for apartments is 1.5% of inventory, followed by 1.3% for industrial, 0.9% for office, and 0.3% for open-air retail. These historically low levels of new stock additions, combined with the expected decline in new construction, should help aid a recovery in fundamentals when economic growth returns and real estate demand turns positive again. Real estate transaction activity ground to a halt amid the widespread market disruption, which has led to limited transparency on current pricing. The due diligence necessary to complete a property transaction is extremely challenging due to stay-at-home orders and travel restrictions. Debt capital markets came under stress but continued to function. Debt terms reflect higher spreads and lower LTVs, but financing for stabilized assets remains available. In part helped by Fed action, U.S. corporate bond spreads, a leading indicator of potential real estate capital market stress, declined during the month of April. The spread between BAA corporate bond rates and the NCREIF Property Index, or NPI, income yield remains slightly above its 15-year average. This is in contrast to that spread's plunge into negative territory during the global financial crisis and suggests investor interest in high-quality income streams remains resilient. Greg will now review our portfolio's financial performance results for Q1 before I continue. Greg?
Thanks, Alan. We started the year off with total quarterly revenues of $49 million compared to $41 million in the prior year. The increase of $8 million was primarily related to new acquisitions made during the last year. First quarter net loss was $19 million, compared to net income of $107 million in the prior year. The decrease in net income was primarily attributable to a $107 million gain on the sale of 111 Sutter Street in 2019 and non-cash unrealized fair value losses on our investment in the New York City retail portfolio due to COVID-19 impacts on retail and our interest rate swaps as a result of the large decrease in interest rates over the quarter. Funds from operation, or FFO, is a supplemental measure of operating performance used by the real estate industry, which most closely resembles GAAP net income. For the quarter ended March 31st, we reported FFO of $9.8 million, or 6 cents per share, a decrease of 5 cents per share from Q1 2019, primarily as a result of non-cash fair value adjustments to our interest rate swaps, acquisition expenses, and reserves for uncollectible rents. We also track AFFO as a supplemental measure of operating performance. AFFO is calculated as FFO adjusted for non-operating expenses and non-cash items. AFFO in the first quarter was $18.4 million, an increase of 12% over the prior year, primarily related to the new acquisitions we had made over the last year. Q1 AFFO was 11 cents per share. COVID-19 had a minimal impact in the first quarter of 2020, as rent is paid at the beginning of the month and we collected our normal amounts of rent for the month of March. As of the end of April, we collected approximately 85% of our April rent. We have received requests for rent relief from tenants representing approximately 21% of our monthly revenue. We have granted rent relief for tenants representing approximately 4% of our monthly revenue. We expect to recover the unpaid rent from a significant number of these tenants over a longer period of time or to extend their leases to cover the lost rent revenue. We also expect our credit losses to increase significantly during the second quarter when compared to our recent operating history. Portfolio occupancy remained consistent at 95% throughout the first quarter. Our occupancies by segment were 99% for industrial, 94% for apartment, 91% for grocery-anchored retail, and 86% for office. Maintaining higher occupancies through active tenant retention strategies continues to be a priority for our asset management team. We strive to offer a reliable and attractive level of current income to our stockholders that steadily grows over time. On May 5th, 2020, our board of directors approved a gross dividend for the second quarter of 2020 of 13.5 cents per share. The dividend is payable on or around June 29, 2020, to stockholders of record as of June 24, 2020. All stockholders should receive 13.5 cents per share, less applicable share class specific fees, and the annualized yield will differ based on the share class. Since we launched our initial public offering in October of 2012, we have provided net of fees annualized income returns of 4.1%, appreciation returns of 2.4%, for a total return of 6.6% over that 7.5-year period. Our NAV was over $2.1 billion at the end of the first quarter. Our daily NAV methodology has provided stable market valuations, as evidenced by our sub 2% standard deviation of share price. Towards the end of the quarter, our independent valuation advisor, RERC, determined that the near-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic had impacted the values of certain of our properties. The appraisals resulted in an approximate $41 million or 1.4% decline in our approximate $3 billion gross asset value and an approximate 2% decline in our net asset value. Property sectors most impacted were our grocery-anchored retail portfolio, our two parking garages, and our only student-oriented apartment community. Now, I'll hand the call back over to Alan to highlight some Q1 accomplishments.
Thanks, Greg. To highlight Q1 strategic accomplishments, we acquired two new properties and disposed of one industrial building and a small retail property in the New York City retail portfolio. At the end of January, we acquired Milford Crossing, a 159,000 square foot grocery-anchored retail center located in Milford, Massachusetts, for approximately $42 million. Additionally, in February, we acquired Fountainhead Corporate Park, a 295,000 square foot Class A office portfolio comprised of two six-story buildings located in Phoenix, Arizona submarket of Tempe for approximately $62 million. At the end of the quarter, we sold a 31,000 square foot industrial building, which was part of our Valencia industrial portfolio, for approximately $5.6 million. As of March 31st, our portfolio diversification by property type was 33% apartments, 26% grocery anchored retail, 25% industrial, 15% office, and 1% other, which currently consists of two parking garages. We look forward to further expanding and diversifying our portfolio in the coming year, though our investment pace will likely be delayed until later in the year given current market disruptions. Our overall company leverage ratio increased moderately to 37% at the end of Q1. Nearly 90% of our borrowings are at a fixed rate. We have limited near-term mortgage maturities with aggregate loan balances of $42 million coming due over the next 2 years. Our portfolio-wide weighted average remaining loan term is approximately 6 years, and our weighted average interest rate on outstanding borrowings is 3.6%. Turning to our stock transaction activity, in Q1, we repurchased approximately $93 million in shares pursuant to our share repurchase plan, which had a first quarter limit of $103 million. For the second quarter 2020, share repurchases will have a limit of approximately $104 million, which is 5% of the NAV of the company as of March 31st. We believe the volume of share repurchase requests for the first quarter was larger than our historical experience, given the significant volatility across all asset classes in the quarter, coupled with the growing concerns regarding COVID-19 and its near and longer-term impacts on the U.S. economy. Stockholders should aspire to be long-term investors and hold our shares for 5 to 7 years or longer. However, during normal market conditions, our share repurchase plan is available to stockholders subject to the quarterly limits and a 12-month holding period. Our board of directors has the right to modify or suspend the share repurchase plan if it deems such action to be in the best interest of our stockholders. Given the near shutdown in real estate capital markets activity previously discussed, we expect our investing pace to slow dramatically at least for the next few months, possibly longer, until stay-at-home orders are lifted and businesses broadly reopen. The due diligence necessary to complete property investing transactions will be challenging. Our lower leverage, strong liquidity, and recent capital raising success positions us well to weather the current turbulent environment and seize on attractive investment opportunities once they present themselves. Post-COVID-19, we intend to focus on investing capital in the industrial and apartment sectors, as well as complementary low beta strategies such as medical office, which fulfill key portfolio investment goals of reliable income and moderate NAV growth over time. During Q1, we reinvested approximately $2.5 million of capital improvements into our existing portfolio, all geared towards maintaining our higher occupancies. We will be thoughtful with our capital improvement expenditures for the remainder of the year as we continue to assess the impacts of COVID-19 on our existing portfolio. In closing, I would like to thank our incredibly talented team for their remarkable dedication as we navigate through these uncertain times. Our portfolio, asset, and property managers are adapting admirably to the challenges being presented by the pandemic and are rising to the occasion. Throughout our history, whether it be our sponsor, JLL, and their 200-plus years in real estate, or our investment advisor, LaSalle, and its 40-plus years as a fiduciary for investors in real estate, we have shown a remarkable capacity to successfully navigate turbulent times and deliver excellent results for investors over the long term. We believe our client-first culture shines in these moments, and our long-term strategy, strong balance sheet, and best-in-industry talent enable us to successfully navigate through these disruptions during this unprecedented period. Over the last 7.5 years, we have built what we believe to be a strong, stable real estate fund with a conservative strategy and resilient balance sheet, and we will remain true to our disciplined core investment philosophy. Please continue to speak with your normal JLL Income Property Trust contact should you have any questions or concerns. We appreciate the trust you place in us, and we wish all of you and your families good health and safety while we work through these challenging times. Thank you for your time and attention today, and I hope you found our remarks informative. Operator, we would now like to open the call for any questions.
At this time, I will open the lines for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we pull for questions.
First, I would like to introduce Sean Meehan. He has joined us to help with any Q&A that might come up. Sean is our senior portfolio manager. I do have a number of questions that I've received, Alan and Sean, so I will go ahead and ask a couple while we wait for questions to come in. Alan, could you comment on the current status of the share repurchase plan?
Yeah, Greg, and that's certainly one of the questions we're getting a lot of interest today. And as we covered in our prepared remarks, and even in the 10Q filing, historically we've had relatively negligible share repurchase activity. We very much try to invest on, impress upon our stockholders that this is income property trust and funds like us should be viewed as long-term investments. We're into the second quarter here. We're not quite halfway into the second quarter, but we're a little bit over half of the share repurchase activity. It's 5% of our NAV. So for the second quarter, I think it's about $105 million. Again, all of the NAV reprograms have a similar capacity to repurchase shares, but the limitations are governed by the SEC. I do know in times of stress and times of volatile financial markets, investors tend to often worry about longer-term investments like this, but I do believe the fundamental premise of commercial real estate for the long term still makes a lot of sense, and hope investors hold through kind of this downturn period. But that's the level of repurchase activity, and we'll continue to report that out publicly if anything changes.
Operator, are there any questions on the line?
Yes, our first question is from Spencer Wright. Please proceed with your question. And Spencer, your line is open. Please make sure you're not on mute.
Sorry about that, rookie mistake. Thanks for the presentation today, guys. My firm does use JLL, and we're looking to actually, I think, increase our allocation. But I had some questions today. My primary question is, given the obviously the environment we find ourselves in, how much stress do you think the portfolio can withstand and still continue to make distributions?
Yeah, Spencer, I'll take that. And then, Greg, I might ask you to add a little more color on other factors as it relates to dividend setting. You know, Spencer, we've paid dividends now for, I think it's 33 or 34 straight quarters, so a little almost 8 years. We very much strive to be a source of reliable income. I will remind that every quarter management makes recommendations to the board, and ultimately the dividend decisions are up to the board of directors. It's one of the more impactful decisions that, you know, goes right to our board. We have historically covered our cash flow pretty well, and we don't have the highest dividend in the marketplace. So our more conservative approach to dividends gives us confidence that, you know, we ought to be able to sustain it. We have done some level of stress testing in terms of kind of rent deferrals or even loss of rents and our ability to sustain that dividend. We're confident that we can continue to pay that distribution we're paying. You know, Greg, you want to comment on kind of other areas, whether it's our LTV and then the level of stress testing that we've done that we feel like can, allows us to continue to pay the dividend, just kind of high level there.
Yeah, so, you know, we've always been a very low leverage strategy here. We have minimal debt maturities coming due. You know, we see a lot of free cash flow coming in, even under the stress conditions where we have assumed that, you know, we continue to collect much less than 100% of our dividend. We still feel pretty confident in the level of cash flows that we're generating. So, but, you know, everything's really, you know, our dividend policy is determined by the board of directors. But, you know, under the kind of current stress test scenarios, we feel pretty confident right now.
That's great. If I could have one more follow-on. Are you experiencing a lot of stress in the portfolio right now as far as people with an inability to pay, or is the, you know, your principal strategy with, you know, anchor grocery stores and things like that, it seems to work very well for you these many years, is that really paying off now?
Yeah, Spencer, we think it's going to continue to pay off. You know, across the portfolio, you know, each property type has a different lease term, and each property type has a different tenant. We had a largest allocation today in our portfolio is apartments, and we had a very high collection rate of rents for apartments for the first quarter and obviously even for April, and collections across the apartment sector feel very strong for early on in May. Greg mentioned in his prepared remarks that we had a significant request for rent relief. I think it was greater than 20% of the gross revenues of the portfolio, but we granted less than 4% of rent relief. In these sorts of times, especially with some of our commercial tenants, not necessarily our grocery tenants, but even some of the warehouse tenants, some of the non-grocer retail tenants, even some of our office tenants, you know, it's often a typical part of a company's playbook, and CFOs understand this, that in these sorts of kind of down times, that they might ask their landlords to help them out like they might ask their banks to help them out. That said, leases are pretty senior obligations in the credit stack, and when you push back on some of those tenants in terms of really, well, why are you asking for rent relief? You know, what does your financials look like? You know, do we need to be concerned about your, you know, business continuity procedures and your ability to sustain? We had a significant number of tenants when you actually push back, they went ahead and paid rent. So our bias towards higher credit tenants, I think, will help us. Our bias towards a very diversified portfolio will help us. And obviously, there's certain component of our retail portfolio, you know, the smaller shop tenants, some of the local sit-down restaurants in the retail portfolio. We're going to have to work with those, and we are working with those on until they can get their businesses reopened. You know, a lot of them have been forced to be closed by local governments, but our grocers are open, our pharmacy are open, our banks are open, a lot of the fast food is open. So we feel good about the overall diversification and overall our collections kind of for the April and the early read on May. So we're keeping our fingers crossed and doing everything we can to keep the cash flow going.
Thank you very much. That was That was excellent. Thank you for your time.
And our next question is from Seth Kaplan. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My question has to do with the portfolio value that you indicated. Is that a reflection of the entire portfolio being reappraised during the month of March, or is this part of a rolling process of appraisal, and where is your sense of where those values are going if things stay static as they are right now? Thank you.
Yeah, Seth, thanks for that question. I'll cover the first part of that question, and then, Sean, I'll ask you to provide a little bit more color on some of the valuation impacts we recognized kind of towards the end of March, and any sort of kind of insights that you're seeing on valuations now coming in. I'll address the process. First off, every single property in our portfolio is independently appraised every single quarter by a third-party fiduciary who's a named fiduciary in our SEC filings, a firm called RERC, more used to be known as Real Estate Research Corporation, and then they adopted the acronym. They report directly to our board of directors, and they mark every position in the portfolio, and they really do that by doing an appraisal every 90 days. And throughout the 90-day period, every property gets reappraised kind of on a rotational basis. So it's almost such that every single day a new property gets reappraised, and the increase or decrease in the value of that property over what it was appraised at last quarter, you know, goes directly into our gross asset value, and then we subtract the stated value of our debt, and then that gets us to our NAV. We feel like we have kind of the gold standard and one of the most transparent and arm's-length valuation processes in the industry, and we feel like it stood the test of time, and we're one of the few programs in the market that actually has sold properties over our 7.5-year history and kind of proven up the valuation by actually taking properties to market. So we feel good about our valuation-based kind of share price calculation every day. Certainly, we communicate regularly and real-time with RERC. They're getting real-time information as to collections, as to changes in any of the makeup or the portfolio and leases. We had a modest decline in values recognized at the end of March. Sean, I'll hand it to you, and why don't you talk about kind of the impacts. I'd say the one thing that we're seeing first as far as impact is kind of valuation impacts that are near-term cash flow, just given the current environment. But, Sean, why don't you walk through a little bit more color on the valuation impact at the end of March and what we're seeing early into April.
Sure, Alan. Hey, Seth. So at the end of April, we had 15 of our assets reappraised in that last week, at the end of March. At the end of March, around March 26th to the 31st or so, and that represented nearly 30% of our gross asset value, and that 30% of value is where we thought there was some near-term cash flow risk or stress. Alan just mentioned where we're seeing it in our retail portfolio, some stress with maybe full-service restaurants or we have a couple fitness gym centers. We have two movie theaters. And so it's really what was done at the end of March was to increase credit loss reserves. So if normally we would expect, say, $100 of rent, in the appraisals, RERC is underwrote to expect, say, $90 of rent. So increasing credit loss reserves to maybe 10% or so in the near term for some of those assets, and also decreasing rent growth projections in the near term, and then stabilizing after a 2 or 3 year period for those properties. And that led to the lion's share of the portfolio level write down, which at the fund level was about 1.5% of gross asset value, closer to 2% in NAV. Looking forward, for April and May, I would expect as long as the economy generally is is in a closed position, for lack of a better term. I would expect there to be, I think it would not be unrealistic to think there'd be a similar trajectory of very modest declines. You know, I'm thinking, you know, in that same level of maybe 1% or so, or it's, you know, obviously we don't know what the values are going to be, and it's really up to RERC, our independent appraiser, but it's just intuition would tell me that if job, you know, given what we saw with the jobs market in April, with GDP in April, you know, a modest decline probably would be more expected than an uptick, all things equal. I would also say, though, that just as a reminder, and I think this was covered earlier in the call, but we really feel good about where our portfolio is positioned overall. We have two-thirds of our portfolio in what I would categorize as highly defensive sectors, especially in this new environment. So two-thirds being a multifamily, industrial, medical office. And even our grocers, we only invest in the very best locations across the country for grocers. And what we're looking, where we're looking to invest are going to be the dominant grocer in a trade area, in a very affluent area, and also dense locations with low rates of competition from other grocers and service sectors. So we feel really strongly that that sector is going to make a strong recovery just as soon as you start seeing some of the stay-at-home orders lifted and, you know, people getting back to work. So hopefully that was helpful and gave you a little bit of context.
Yeah, I it was very helpful. And, you know, what I took away from that, and I'll make the statement and you can correct me, is as we go through the next couple of months where through your rolling appraisals, as those are completed, it wouldn't be surprising to see the type of decline that we saw really during the month of March continue into April in May, assuming the status quo, and then perhaps level off, assuming things don't degrade further from here. Is that reasonable?
I think you said that better than I was struggling to, yes.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate the time.
And our next question is from Jeffrey Scales. Please proceed with your question.
Good afternoon, and thank you for doing this call and for providing such a great deal of disclosure like JNL, you historically have done. And thank you, Alan, and your team for continued work. I have two questions. One of them won't surprise you at all. That is whether or not you are going to consider in your other category in the future, other than, for example, parking garages, would you consider having any kind of renewable energy project, infrastructure-based project, whether they be commercial solar or wind, for example? And then the other question is, would you plan in the future more diversity outside of mostly or all domestic-based property?
Great, Jeff. Thanks for the call, and good to hear your voice, and I hope you and your family and everyone are fine and healthy and kind of managing through this kind of bizarre environment we're all in. But let me, in terms of our other allocation, let me first say, I think one of the strengths, when we look back on kind of wherever we are today and we look back 6 months from now, and we look at how real estate was impacted by this global pandemic, I think it's going to be one of the hallmarks of income property trust performance was that we actually stuck to our knitting and we stuck to the four primary property types. We've been very diversified, both geographically and property type. But we resist the temptation to move out the risk curve and more new age avant-garde real estate. And I do think it's worth highlighting that we don't have any hotels or hospitality in our portfolio. We don't have any senior living, which has really been terribly impacted. We have one small, less than 1% student-oriented portfolio, and had sold out of our student portfolio a couple of years ago. And obviously, with all the schools being closed, those sorts of assets are going to be materially impacted. So I feel like we've really probably helped our investors by being disciplined and focused. Now, I will say, in terms of renewable energy and infrastructure and just focusing on the ESG initiatives more broadly, it is very much a high priority of both our parent JLL, our advisor LaSalle, and certainly Income Property Trust. We are one of the leading funds in the marketplace in terms of capturing and tracking our ESG characteristics, reducing our carbon footprint, and initiating, you know, clean energy and clean characteristics as it relates to our portfolio. And we do have a number of properties where we continue to add things like solar panels. We have an office building in New Jersey that all the parking decks are covered with solar. And so we're focused on doing that within the portfolio. In terms of going out and focusing on specifically energy kind of driven infrastructure investments, those tend to be pretty large and maybe even out of the scope, even though we're a $3 billion fund today. You know, those investments often are many, many hundreds of millions of dollars, at least at kind of the institutional scale. So I see our attention to be more focused on those opportunities within our portfolio than doing that directly. In terms of diversifying outside the United States, you know, it's still a priority of ours to continue to broadly diversify. I think we certainly, I would say over the last few years, it's been a good thing that we stayed at home. The non-U.S. markets have been more impacted, and certainly the flight to capital and the strength of the U.S., although we do continue to monitor, and I think, as you know, our advisor has almost two-thirds of its assets under management and almost two-thirds of our people outside the United States. So we continue to watch for other good core yield-oriented investments outside the U.S. I do think I don't see that happening in the balance of 2020 until the kind of global pandemic settles down and then markets tend to recover. I do think there's, you know, I've always been a big fan of global trade and globalization. It will be very interesting to see how this sort of healthcare crisis globally does impact, you know, the trend towards more national interests or more towards global trade and global manufacturing. But we'll have to keep a monitoring of that.
Okay, thank you, Alan, and good to hear your voice. This will help.
And there are no further questions at this time. Therefore, I'll return back to Greg Fox for any further questions.
Yeah, Alan and John, I have a few more questions here that I want you to cover if you can. Can you provide any insights into what's happening with our grocery-anchored retail portfolio?
Yeah, Greg, at a high level, you know, I would say our grocery-anchored retail strategy, as Sean already commented, you know, we've been very focused on what we consider to be the best locations, the best properties, best demographics, and the best grocers. You know, across our grocery-anchored center, you know, the grocers, the grocery stores, the pharmacies, they all had record-setting sales in Q1. So we feel very good about our locations, the demographics, the properties where we're located, but it's also an environment where, you know, a lot of the grocery anchored centers, we do have some level of small local tenants and businesses, whether they be sit-down restaurants or other sort of services, you know, places where you get your hair cut, get your nails done, get your teeth whitened. You know, those have been deemed non-essential businesses in many jurisdictions around the country, and those have been forced to close. And so we have had to partner with some of those tenants in terms of granting either rent deferrals or some sort of rent temporary rent abatements because they've been closed. I think it's never been a more challenging time to be an owner and a landlord of real estate in this sort of environment where local businesses that are well-run and well-operated but have been forced to kind of have their businesses materially hurt. So it's been our playbook to try to work and partner with those. We want these tenants to open back up. We want to be sure that we're not spending the capital to re-tenant spaces if there's good businesses that once the economy reopens that they'll be able to recover. So it's a mix of great strength and resiliency in our grocers and our pharmacies and some of our fast food, but obviously some challenges with some of the smaller local businesses, and we're working through that with them and hoping that America reopens soon enough and people can return to business.
Great, thanks. Can you describe how the current environment will impact our office portfolio going forward?
Yeah, I know that question came in, Greg, and so I had a chance to think about that a second. So first off, office is our lowest allocation within the overall portfolio. It's about 15% of our portfolio. You know, that's a material underweight because office properties are the largest component of U.S. real estate. So when you have a 15% allocation to something that's the largest component, it's a big underweight. We've been underweight office, especially over the last few years, because office properties, often because of the capital required to re-tenant properties and pay leasing commissions and outfit offices, you know, owners of office buildings have to put a lot more capital back into those properties. And if you're putting a lot of the cash flow back into the property, you can't pay as much out in dividends. So we've been underweight office because we're kind of focused on properties that generate more free cash flow. The half of the component of our office properties is medical office, and we do like medical office, and that's a continued kind of opportunity for us to further invest in that. When markets open back up, you'll see us probably invest in more medical office. We like healthcare-oriented real estate for the long term. The long-term demographics of hospital procedures being done in more of an office setting, in a surgery center type setting, the trends are very, very positive. There's no place more expensive in the face of the earth than getting something treated at a hospital. So anything that any sort of treatments that can be outsourced, outplacement in doctor's offices and surgery centers is a much more efficient way, and we don't think that's going to change. And so we like medical offices, and we like that half of our office allocation is office. I couldn't be more pleased that, in fact, in this quarter a year ago, first quarter, the quarter that we're reporting on now, and Greg commented in his pre-prepared remarks that we sold out of what, you know, for 6 or 7 years of the fund we thought was one of the crown jewel properties, which was our multi-tenant office building in downtown San Francisco, an investment at more than $200 million. It had grown to be too much of our fund, and we just felt like we wanted to take risk off and sell out of San Francisco, which is a very volatile market. And so I'm really glad we've done that now. I think that could have been something in the portfolio that would have been even more severely impacted by the current environment. So we're gonna look at medical office, but we're gonna generally be underweight to office over the long term, I think.
Great. Another question here was, how is rent growth going to be impacted by the various property types going forward?
Yeah, Sean, you want to talk a little bit about kind of what's normal in terms of our rent growth outlook, kind of as we came into this pandemic, we certainly, the supply and demand fundamentals were very much in balance for real estate. And you know, I think most landlords thought it was a good opportunity for healthy rent growth. We still think we'll see rent growth, but it's probably going to be a little bit slower than what we had forecasted, you know, even 60 days ago. Sean, you want to give everyone a little more color on that, please?
Sure, and I did, as I alluded to in my prior response, we are expecting with what we've seen with jobs and GDP, you know, there's some correlation of rent growth there, and so we're expecting generally a softening up of what might typically be a 3% rent growth assumption in real estate forecast models. That's been throttled back, depending on sector and location, you know, to 2%, 1%, sometimes flat or 0%, as I was just referring to with some of the retail sector. You know, but I'd say for our fund specifically, our rent growth projections are calculated by our in-house research and strategy group, who maintains a proprietary database for each sector, so each sector being office, multifamily, et cetera. And then for each sector, they'll track the top 50 to 100 markets, each one having its own unique supply and demand fundamentals, volatility, job outlook, and so forth. So there's very many variables at play, and it's a pretty scientific exercise. There's obviously also some judgment and art applied to our thinking on rent growth as well. But just to get pretty granular there, we do project out by market and by sector at a pretty granular level for about 3 to 4 years, which is as far forward as typically you can see for supply, demand, and et cetera. And then we'll apply a long-term inflationary growth factor. And so, as I just mentioned, that long-term inflationary growth factor, rather than being, say, 3%, it's down in the near term. So over the next 12 to 24 months, we should expect some softness before recovery.
Great, thanks. And then the last question I have is, do you think you'll be able to take advantage of any buying opportunities as a result of the current economic environment?
Yeah, you know, Greg, that's probably the $10,000 question. As you and I both covered in our pre-prepared remarks, the real estate capital markets has slowed dramatically, principally because of the due diligence required. You know, it normally when we're looking at investing in a property over a period of a number of months, we would have dozens of people, both within our firm and then outside experts we hire, visit those properties to walk them, to go on the roofs, to look at the elevators, go into the basement, check out the boilers. I don't know if people have boilers anymore, but anyway, I dated myself there. That has been shut down. And until America can travel and businesses are open and we can go talk to tenants, you know, the real estate capital markets are going to be shut down for a little bit longer. That said, you know, we've talked both internally and we've talked to a lot of the home offices and advisors that invest with us. You know, we were a pretty frustrated investor last year in terms of seeing a lot of competition for buying the high quality core properties that we would like to add to income property trust portfolio. There was certainly more highly leveraged buyers that, you know, our low leverage approach and you know, the same buyer, two potential investors going after the same property, one of them is leveraging at 40%, and that's us, and our competition is leveraging the property at 80%. When it comes down to who can put the last million or 2 million or 5 million on the table, the highly leveraged buyer is a little bit easier to convince themselves that, hey, I think I can still get my required return by just goosing the leverage a little bit. And so we've been very disciplined in keeping our leverage low over the last year, and we're very happy for that now. I do think when the capital markets reopen and debt markets reopen, there will be some of those more highly leveraged buyers that I don't think you're going to see massive distress in the real estate markets because the supply and demand fundamentals are still pretty positive. And as I covered in my pre-prepared remarks, there's very little new construction across all four primary property types. So we still think it'll be a good investing opportunity, but we think there'll be less competition out there. We think the more highly leveraged buyer will probably have to sit on the sidelines. And to the extent that any of these properties have near-term, you know, cash flow struggles over the kind of hopefully the 3 to 6 month time period that this pandemic kind of shuts down America, we think some of those highly leveraged buyers might have to sell things. You're also hearing comments about some of the institutional open-end funds that may be sellers as a lot of the institutional investors have to rebalance and their equities portfolio is down. And so they have to take a little bit of money off their real estate allocation. That could be a good opportunity for us to still, we're not going to take more risk in the portfolio. We're going to continue to buy high quality, good located, well located, strong cash flowing assets, but I think we may be able to buy them at better returns over the next, you know, year or so than maybe we've been over the last year or so. Our expectation is that it might take into the fourth quarter or even into 2021 to find those opportunities, but we're going to keep looking for them and we'll be eager to add them to our portfolio.
That was my last question, operator.
Sure. There are no other questions, and this concludes today's call. I will hand the call back to Alan Swearingen for closing remarks. Alan?
Yeah, well, thank you all for joining us here for our first quarter recap. Hopefully everyone is safe and dealing kind of with this unprecedented environment, and we look forward to updating you next quarter on, you know, our regular earnings calls here. Thank you for taking the time to dial in and join us today. Goodbye now.